And the moment you preach that and you do it in a way that respects both sides, and mm-hmm. you mention and you say, like, and listen, you might disagree with me, and that's fine. That's totally fine. Come talk to me. Let's go have coffee. You will get people calling and saying, how do I sign up? Because it's breaking my heart, and I know these are our friends, mm-hmm. and I want to do something about it.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. To show hospitality to the stranger and the traveler are not new mandates for God's people. So what happens when your political, cultural, legal contexts make that harder to do? Today, we're going to talk about immigration, refugees, community, and ministry in Episcopal churches. Though I really believe that whatever tradition you're coming from as you listen today, you're going to find something of interest and that's applicable to you as well. How, in a time when the fear and the complexity around immigration are only on the rise, can all kinds of churches move from maybe no involvement to hospitality to partnership with the immigrant communities around them? Today's episode is from a conversation that we co-hosted with the Episcopal Parish Network, and we were able to talk with some incredibly wise pastoral and practical people to explore how congregations can engage more faithfully and effectively with immigrant neighbors. We do dip into a bit of theology here and there, but this is more strategic application today, legal context and pastoral insight for building authentic relationships and deepening mission in an area that can be very tricky or can still feel to some folks morally ambiguous. And so the goal was for this conversation to offer a lot of clarity here, and I think that it does. We discuss some of the legal landscapes around immigration, what's true, what's not true, how to find out, how it affects ministry, pastoral care that is culturally responsive instead of awkward or well-meaningly clueless, cooperating with ethnic leaders to support and empower immigrants and their families, and practical tips that you can try. This conversation is about building wise bridges across borders of all kinds, discerning the opportunities that God has put in front of you, making a solid plan, and accepting the time and the help that it takes to build bridges that last. Our guests are also going to mention a few key resources like websites that you can look up after the conversation, and we'll put all of those in the show notes today. Who are our guests? They include the Reverend Dr. Samira Izadi Page, attorney James Montana, the Reverend Christian Anderson, and the Reverend Jaime Briceño, and I'll introduce them more in a moment. First, thanks to the Episcopal Parish Network for making this conversation possible. This is an episode that I highly recommend, when you're done listening, that you share with someone. It is timely, practical, at times I found it surprising, and it is very rooted in the gospel. I can't wait to share it with you. So, without further ado, we hope you enjoy the conversation. We've got a great group of ministers, thinkers, pastors, community servants here today. First, I want to introduce you to the Reverend Dr. Samira Izadi Page. She is founder and executive director of an organization called Gateway of Grace, which is a holistic ministry to refugees in Dallas, Texas. She herself is a daughter of Iran who fled due to persecution, and she has navigated political asylum and residency in the U.S. She is the author of the book, Who is My Neighbor?, and co-editor of No Longer Strangers. She's also a popular speaker on mission, interfaith relations, refugee outreach, and bringing the love of Christ to people whose dignity has been compromised by oppressive governments and circumstances. We also have James Montana, Esquire. He is an immigration lawyer and the principal at James Montana Law, and he is up in Falls Church, Virginia. He began practicing law at Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Washington. He currently represents indigent clients pro bono before the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia. That, I'm sure, is no easy job right now or ever. And he serves as a director of the Borromeo Legal Project, Incorporated, named, of course, after St. Charles Borromeo. And that provides free service to low-income clients who seek to naturalize and become U.S. citizens. And then we have calling in from Berwyn, Illinois, 6 miles outside of Chicago, the Reverend Jaime Briceño. He's the rector at St. Michael and All Angels Episcopal Church, where he integrates liberation theology, very cool, into parish life and champions interreligious dialogue. His ministry includes a daycare center that supports low-income families. He is a son of Costa Rica. He also taught ethics there at La Universidad Latinoamericana de Ciencia y Tecnología. And so he brings IT expertise to the table along with passions for social justice and racial equity. We also finally have the Reverend Christian Anderson. He is the Vicar of Operations at St. Mary's in Stuart, Florida. He leads their efforts to develop practical support for immigrant communities. In a former life, he was an actor. He's also a speaker and a coach, and he's the host of an online talk show called The Poor, P-O-U-R, which uses humor to discuss serious topics. And I'm sorry, I can't help myself, Father Christian. I have to give your Instagram handle, which is at your favorite Christian, your_favorite_Christian. Well, thank you all for being here today. I've just read your bios, but the first thing I'd like to hear from each of you, what does your work look like today vis-a-vis U.S. immigrant communities? How could you paint a little picture for us? Samira, can we start with you?
Sure. It's been recent months have been strange, painful in many ways. Seeing the suffering of those whom we love and serve is very difficult. At the same time, we have seen our communities coming together, and we have seen God at work in the lives of the displaced people, bringing them healing and joy and using them. You know, it's always ministry life, you know, like any other situation and time in our life is a mixed bag of sorrows and joys. These past few months, it's been a strange.
Mother Samira, could you share with everyone the countries that the people in your ministries, where are they mainly coming from? If there is, you know, if there's sort of a top 3 to 5 countries that they're coming from right now.
So for the past few years, we have been receiving refugees mostly from Afghanistan and from the Congo, Republic of Congo. And we, at Gateway of Grace, we serve refugees from 16 different countries. And, you know, the shift has been for the past few months that we are not getting new refugees into the country, but we are receiving new refugees to us who have been basically, for the lack of resources, have been displaced again from the organizations that they used to be with to now having no one to support them. And we've been receiving those families as well.
Okay. Thank you. James, can you give us a little slice of life of who you're serving and what that looks like right now?
Sure. So our law office helps people who are pursuing asylum, who are applying for green cards based on marriage, who are fighting deportation. I would say that there are two sides to the immigration bureaucracy right now. One side is exactly the way it was a year ago, and the other side has moved into high gear and is much more focused on enforcement and is also much more chaotic and brutal. So our life is half the same as it used to be and half very, very different.
Christian, how about you?
I think right now it's continuing to build the team, building the resources, building the community. And so what I mean by that is just that we have an ICE office right in our town. So the numbers are really high. Mm. And so how do we become this resource that people can trust that we are there for all the different ways that we can serve the immigrant community? But then also how are we building community with the sheriff to say, hey, we got to do what we got to do as clergy, and then building trust. And so that's just a lot of communication, and then finding out and then asking the communities, where do you want to fit in? And then in the midst of all, which was said before, there's just so much heartbreak that comes in the midst of it. And so there's all those great pastoral needs. So we're just trying to listen and then act upon that listening right now.
Okay, thank you. We're in a period of heightened anxiety. So are you kind of, you know, rebuilding or reconsidering strategies, rebuilding relationships right now? Just trying to get a sense if you're sort of thinking, rethinking a previous ministry, or if you're just building one?
I think, thanks be to God, we're leveraging the work that has been done, I think, the last 8-9 years, which was building relationships with, especially in our context, a lot of Guatemalan and Mexican communities. And so if we didn't have that and we weren't in relationship, this would be a whole different story right now. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, those relationships have been there. So I guess this is putting it from first into fifth year.
Okay. Yeah, that does answer my question. Thank you. Because people will be at all different places along this journey. So that's very helpful.
Yeah.
Father Jaime, I'd love to hear from you. What's going on in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, well, we were put into the forefront of this, whether accidentally or by design, when the buses started arriving a few years ago with migrants from different bordered states. And that puts us into the situation of really creating networks of care and support. We open our house here at the church for recent arrival immigrants, and they're living with us in the house. And we had also found that a lot of the recent arrival immigrants had fallen to the cracks of what DCFS in Illinois provides for daycare support for families. So if your family doesn't have all the right legal status, the state doesn't provide you for daycare. So we have to supplement free daycare for people. And that's part of the work we're doing these days. So housing and daycare, like what we do every day.
Are there certain geographic locations that most of your neighbors are coming from?
Venezuela, yes.
Venezuela, okay.
Right. And then we have, you know, and then we found ourselves being targeted by the current administration and its immigration policies. So a lot of our not so recent arrival immigrants from Mexico feel really targeted. And so we have a large portion of our community now that without any desire of their own, they feel themselves trapped in their houses. And they tell me, you know, they show up once, and I haven't seen them in a while. And they tell me, we're not going to come into church because we are afraid of being picked up at ICE.
So this is sort of an informal house arrest.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all so much. I want to ask some questions that are based on conversations I've had over the past couple of weeks with Episcopal and Anglican priests. And a lot of these questions have to do with how churches can build healthy and lasting networks of care and support. Aggression against immigrant communities is ramping up, but there's also a lot of uncertainty, confusion among people of goodwill about what to do, how to go about it. So how can churches participate? The first question I'd like to ask you is how people can find the immigrant communities that are near them. Sometimes they're within your own church. Sometimes it's very evident. Sometimes it's not. But then how do you make that initial connection, if you haven't yet, with immigrant communities in a wise way?
Well, when we talk about immigrant communities, we are talking about communities that are already existing. So we are not trying to find them. We are trying to enter into a relationship with them. And we see their members everywhere. They can be our coworkers. They can be at the grocery store or sitting in our pews. So we can use them as bridges to build relationships and identify the ethnic leaders. I'd say the most important step is identifying the leaders, because those are the ones who know the leaders. Ethnic leaders are the ones who have the trust of the community. They know what's going on and they know what the needs are and how we can best serve those needs. For example, when we have, you know, an Arab refugee, we seek a pastor who is an Arabic speaking pastor or Arabic speaking leader to connect the ethnic person to their community and to build a relationship that we can leverage then for serving other people within the community. And likewise, when people connect with me, they are not just connecting with me, they are building relationships that would serve, again, as a bridge to building relationship with the entire, you know, Farsi-speaking community or Urdu-speaking community. A few days ago, we had a bishop consecration, And we have Bishop Pogo, Secretary General of the Anglican Communion, and he was here, and we were able to bring the leaders, because we had those leaders in the community and had those relationships, we were able to bring three congregations from Farsi-speaking community to Urdu-speaking to Igbo-speaking for them to hear from each other. So yes, building relationships with the leaders is the key, ethnic leaders.
Thank you. Christian.
Yeah, so for us and for a lot of Episcopal churches, it's usually a pretty homogenous community or historically a white community. And so it's, I think this is time has taught us that to make sure you're a missional community, which means you're going outside of your comfort zone and making relationships with communities don't look like you, act like you, talk like you. And so if that work has been done, great. Then you kind of can identify the leaders who you need to be in relationship with. But if those relationships are not there right now, then I would say, especially if you're whatever immigrant community might be vulnerable right now in your area, the churches or religious community is the best way to start. You're just talking. And if you can get your clergy person involved and say, hey, I'm the guy down the street. How can I help? I know this is a very chaotic time and we just want to be here for you. You're not saying the issue exactly, because in our area, there's a lot of fear and a lot of concern. They don't know who's trying to sell out who and who's trying to reveal anything. If you can speak Spanish, and I'm just speaking from my context. If you can speak Spanish, it's even better. But just going to the clergy leader or someone there and saying, we want to help. How can we help? Then they might open up and trust. Then I've started though also with anyone. Like every time I'm at a food truck, a Latino food truck, I will, and it helps probably because I have my collar on, in my broken Spanish, I'll just say, hey man, how's your family? How's your community? How can we help? And then that's usually sort of like a tip off of like, oh, I think he can be trusted. And then it's like, can we help with legal aid? Can we help with food insecurity? Can we help with transportation insecurity? What can we do? We have other staff members who come and help with the cleanup of our campus. Anyone who I can see that I'll just start a conversation, and with those opening questions has led to people saying, yes, please. And then they'll send me to another community leader and then I'll contact them. And now we're in relationship, and how do we get them the support that they need?
Yeah. Thank you. James or Father Jaime, do either of you have some wisdom here that you'd like to share how to make those initial connections with immigrant communities?
In our Episcopal context, one of the things that I really will stress other communities to leverage is their bilingual churches. We don't need to recreate every single ministry in our own little church or big church just because we have the resources to do them. If sometimes the hardest part of creating support for particularly Latino communities is the language and the culture. And if we leverage, you know, the Hispanic communities in your own diocese to do the work, maybe lending the resources that they might have to do that work will have a bigger impact in the community than you trying to do yourself all the work in train yourself in the culture or finding your own staff that is bilingual and all that. So let's say St. Michael and All Angels, we already have a ministry for recent arrival immigrants. And I saw during the time that was, you know, popular here in Chicago, I saw a lot of churches that were spending a lot of resources trying to do that on their own. And I always thought, like, why are you trying to do that on your own? It sounds so hard. Mm-hmm. When we are doing it here, why don't you just come and partner with us? And we know how to do it. We know the people. We know the culture. We know the language. You know, in our context of Chicago, a white church in the northern suburbs, I know it's going to be a harder situation for them to do it culturally. I know they're not going to have any problems to do it with the resources and the money. But the culture clash is going to be hard. And that is a harder part to this ministry that we give a credit.
Can I amen what Father Jaime said? And another side of the coin that he's talking about is, you know, the Episcopal Church is a relatively small church in the big picture of, you know, denominations and churches. And when we have ministries within the Episcopal Church, we don't have the same access to resources that other ministries or other churches. So we are relying on the support, prayers, and friendships of the Episcopalians. of our diocese, of parishes within the diocese, to come alongside us. One aspect of it is that Father Jaime said, you know, the ethnic clergy, that, you know, we have the ministries, we know, you know, what we're doing. The other side of it is the practical side of it, that we need the support of our Episcopalians, our friends, to do this work that's our common ministry as Episcopalians.
James, I'd like to offer you a chance to add to this question if you'd like to.
Building community is something that lawyers are exceptionally bad at, because if you charge by the hour, it's hard to get your conversations. We charge flat fees here. You know, we don't charge by the hour. For us, it's something that brings clients in the door. If they see us at their church, if we're introduced by someone they trust in their faith community, we have a hard enough time just keeping up with the requests for assistance, given the climate that we're in. You know, we try to keep our heads down and do the work. And it, we'd be better off, I think, if we did more community building, but we're imperfect and we have trouble.
You know, this brings me to another question that a pastor asked me, which is about finding organizational partners, which we've partly discussed. But I want to go a little deeper into that question about how to find either a fellow church or a law firm that's doing good work, or another nonprofit, how to find organizational partners to work with so you're not trying to awkwardly reinvent the wheel and make the same failures people have made over and over again. What are some good ways to go about finding those partners? And what are some green flags that would say, oh yeah, this has promise, these people are on the level, they're doing good work, you know, they know. And what are some yellow or red flags that say, these folks might be in the category of when helping hurts? How would you all help people find those solid organizational partners?
So in the immigration law area, there are quite a few nonprofits, most of whom are excellent. But a good starting place is the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, or CLINIC, because they not only have trusted affiliates all over the country, but they also offer webinars and other educational materials for non-legal partners who are looking for information on how to help and what to do. I warmly recommend CLINIC to everybody. You asked, what are some red flags? In the for-profit space, the biggest red flag is someone who's running a notary shop, you know, someone who's just notario publico, or sometimes it'll just say multiservicios or something on the thing that says we do document preparation and other immigration work. These people exploit lots of communities in the United States. We find around DC, especially Central American communities, by portraying themselves as legal professionals when they're not. You know, they may as well be the helpful guy at Staples, but practicing law on the side, and it creates real human misery. So biggest red flag is notarios.
Thank you. That is very good to know. Christian.
We went through Americans for Immigrant Justice, and so they are fantastic. I mean, I think usually this Catholic Church, always a great place to go to, because usually they're much more in tune also with this whole situation in general. Much more than the Episcopalians. So from there, we got a hold of an immigration attorney that they recommended from the local Catholic Church, because they have a huge Guatemalan population. And then we checked in with other ministries that serve Haitian immigrants, Latino, Central American, South American immigrants, and it all kept on coming back to these two or three names. And then we knew there was other names of attorneys that you don't want to recommend, because they'll just take on the case, just like James said, and they'll charge $10,000, $15,000, so they know for a case that's not going to go anywhere. So we found this from just asking a lot of questions from trusted partners who are in the trenches doing the great work. And then that led us to Americans for Immigrant Justice. So now for people who want to just support financially, we have that here. So we have a couple names of attorneys that we like that we just now start to partner and then fund and support. And then, but Americans for Immigrant Justice is a great place to get those allies.
Thank you. And just to say that these, I'm sure, would also be great repositories of legal resources and facts. So I know a lot of people are still asking, how do I know what's true? How do I find facts about what's going on? Find someone who is in the trenches of partnership, ministry service, like the ones we've mentioned today. Those are good places to also find the facts. Samira, yeah.
for serving the families, one effective way would be to look at our own Episcopal Church and the ministries that we already have. Episcopal leaders are already at the front lines of ministry with immigrants and refugees. Many of them lead nonprofits, they're community organizers, and parish-based programs that they lead. So we already have those in many places. And that would be a good way to look for those leaders, for those programs within the Episcopal Church, and support those programs. Again, it's really important for people who serve to have the support of the community, the diocese. I was talking to a bishop 2 days ago from South Texas, and what they are experiencing is just it's just unimaginable. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, we need to support him. So looking at those, and also, you know, when you look at those leaders, you see, you can identify whether they have the trust of the rest of the, you know, diocese or leaders or the community that they serve or not. And that would be a good way, a green flag to know whether that's a good person or organization or program to partner with.
Yeah, and in a very practical sense, for me, I had found that the best partners have come from nonprofit organizations that provide case management. They usually have a lot more context than I do. And because with case management, they do, you know, they have all other networks of people that they have worked with. So trusting those community partners that provide case management, it seemed to be the most effective.
What is it that should go to everyone on your Christmas list this year? Besides a cat a day calendar, I highly recommend one of those. But may I also suggest a few items from the Living Church? For anyone interested in the Anglican family, a Living Church magazine subscription is a great idea. We are the only independent news voice covering the Episcopal Church, Anglican Communion, and beyond. And each issue is packed with unique stories that only we write. Features, book art and film reviews, thoughtful opinion pieces, wise scriptural reflections, and more. And for the clergy in your life, may I recommend our new edition of Pastoral Ministrations of the Priest, a comprehensive collection of liturgical prayers for pastoral situations based on the Book of Common Prayer and a host of traditional sources. Leather-bound, gilt-edged, red-ribboned, great price. Or if your Christmas shopping is done, would you consider a gift to the Living Church? We are a nonprofit ministry. We are in this with you. This podcast, our reporting, our events, books, if we've served you this year in one of these ways, please let us know by leaving us a gift. You can find all these gift options at livingchurch.org under resources, subscribe, or donate. Also, you can check the links in the show notes. The next question that I have for you all involves preaching. A lot of people wonder, what should I say? And when you have folks who are like, we are not saying enough fast enough, you know, we're not giving our people enough courage and encouragement to understand and speak boldly and act boldly in regards to immigration. And other people are saying, oh man, I don't want to drag politics into the pulpit. So many people are tired of that. Both of these sides have content that needs to be considered. However, what is the moment to bring this up in preaching or teaching? What can be said, what needs to be said about immigration when it comes to preaching and teaching the Word of God? Who wants to tackle this one first? Christian, I know it's you.
Just focus on the gospel. And if you focus on the gospel, I think that's what we found. I mean, I serve a parish that's probably, there's probably people of extreme views on either side. And one thing that we all stay focused on is Jesus Christ. And I think anyone who serves the purple parish, that's how you do it. You can't preach the policies. If you preach that, you're going to lose half the people. A couple of weeks ago, we had the gospel about the woman for 18 years, all right, who's in the back of the synagogue, can't get healed. She's been ostracized. And so it was an easy jump to make that Jesus shows up and says, hold up, what about her? She's the one who got left behind. Why is she not healed? And I don't care if it's Sabbath. I will break the law in order for her to be healed. So it wasn't a hard jump to be like, well, guys, let's just name it. Right now in our midst, that woman is the undocumented community. And people are like, oh, okay. All right. And then, so what are we going to do about that as followers of Jesus Christ? You can name a couple stories. I think if you can name a couple stories that you know firsthand of families that have been together 20 years, 15 years, 10 years, you know, law-abiding citizens doing incredible things for our community. Now dad is an alligator Alcatraz. Like, what are we doing here? So with people of who follow Jesus, how do we respond? And you don't tell them how to respond. You offer that to say, how do we do this as followers of Christ? It doesn't hurt that if you say, and yes, yeah, I understand the law, because if you got folks who are just like, no way, man, this is the law, it's been broken. Okay, cool. We still have to care for those who are scared to death inside their homes or going through food insecurity, who are dealing with dad who's a breadwinner who's gone now. We're just going to say, well, tough luck. That's on them. Well, that's not what the Good Samaritan did. He didn't just say tough luck. It's not because he should have been carrying a weapon if he wouldn't have gotten beaten up on the side of the road. No, the Good Samaritan goes to the person. So I think there's almost every Sunday the gospel offers us a way to approach that where someone who might be adamantly against this whole immigration issue, you're still going to be like, oh, I love Jesus. And Jesus is saying, yes, we need care for this. And so, yes, you can hold both up and say, we need to care. We need to do something. And the moment you preach that and you do it in a way that respects both sides and you mention and you say like, and listen, you might disagree with me and that's fine. That's totally fine. Come talk to me. Let's go have coffee. You will get people calling and saying, how do I sign up? Because it's breaking my heart. And I know these are our friends and I want to do something about it. And so that's just in my context, but you guys might have much more to offer than that.
Yeah. I mean, the power of God's word to convict and soften hearts has not changed, fortunately. Mother Samira, you look like you have something burning.
I agree with what was said and add that we also need to remind people of our baptismal covenants that to honor the dignity of each and every human person and individual. So, and that's another aspect of it. And there's also the prophetic aspect. And that, again, when you preach the gospel, that also comes up. But sometimes we need to name the barriers that we have, you know, the fear, the prejudices, the nationalism. And again, we can do it in a way that's respectful, but at the same time, prophetic, because the goal is to bring everyone along and not to leave people behind.
Yes, yes. Thank you for saying that. James, Father Jaime, anything you'd like to speak to here?
As Christians said, context is important in this matter. I don't preach to a white community or have any problems with considering or even wondering the political inclinations of my community. However, it's being very hard to find a way to tell people that they don't have to be afraid when their fear is so vivid and so real. I have found myself very, very troubled with that. I don't preach about that. I've been trying to preach about that, but I have not been able to do it. In the lead up to this, before this was even such a real dynamic that we're living in, my preaching series were about the gospel values. Just centering on those and centering on four values: justice, love, mercy, and forgiveness. And that was it. We didn't talk about that for about 2 years. it was enough, in my experience at least, during this time. If we center in those gospel values, everything else gets spoken for you. You don't have to speak it out. You don't have to be explicit, because they are such a powerful values that anything that goes against them immediately goes against the gospel of Jesus. And then we don't have to worry about them. They're evils that we need to confront.
Thank you. And James, I wondered, you know, you're not clergy, but you go to church, you observe what happens in particular parishes and dioceses. Is there anything you'd want to add here?
One thing that I think is useful to think about from the pews rather than from the pulpit mm-hmm. is that the people in front of you think not just about their obligations as Christians, but of their obligations as citizens, or if they're non-citizens, as residents of this country. And distinguishing for us between our obligations as citizens and our obligations as Christians can be quite enlightening, because I think people think in terms of responsibility broadly without thinking about responsibility to whom, you know, to Caesar or to Christ. And so personally, as someone in the pews, that'd be something I'd be interested in hearing about next Sunday.
I would like now to go more explicitly to the legal side. Someone asked me how they might address reservations in their congregation about assisting people who are undocumented. But I want to broaden this question into, how does a church or a Christian leader decide how to respond to the current enforcement policies, ICE immigration policies of this administration? You know, when does a congregation draw a line in the sand and say, you know, we're happy to obey the law until we get to this point? Jesus was so good at discerning when to do what he needed to do to obey the Father in love. How do churches, I know we're doing it imperfectly, but what are some good tools for discernment there?
So maybe it'll be helpful to talk about what the law says about this before you decide, you know, whether to violate it or not. The law,
yes, that's good.
Says that you can't violate what's called the Alien Harboring Statute, which makes it a crime to assist with illegal migration via providing shelter or assistance to people who are in the United States illegally. Read broadly, that would include every Motel 6 and soup kitchen in America. But historically, the government has read it quite narrowly. There have been prosecutions of sort of humanitarian organizations at the border that do things like leave out water for people who are crossing. Mm-hmm. But those prosecutions have been rare. In practice, if you pay for the application of somebody who's trying to avoid deportation, if you serve as a financial sponsor for somebody who is trying to get a green card, if you volunteer to teach English at a naturalization clinic, you are not going to be touched, even in this administration. So my message as a lawyer to most people is, be not afraid. You can assist with this without any legal liability whatsoever. The question for churches, I think, is different. If you are worried about immigration officials coming into your church, for example, other considerations apply. But for individuals, I think that a broad message of support is appropriate. Engagement and helping immigrant communities is not going to put you in legal jeopardy.
That's extremely helpful. Thank you. Samira, Jaime, Christian, what have you found?
Just a word of caution. We have to be very mindful of both in advocacy, in preaching, of what we say and how we say it. It's good to preach the gospel. It's good to be prophetic. But there's a difference when we get into areas that are explicitly political or legally compromising. And the reason is, what we say matters. Out of love, out of passion for serving the people, we can actually endanger people that we are, the very people that we want to serve. And so we have to be very careful. Most of our ethnic congregations and displaced people, they do not want to draw attention to themselves. And we are a small church. When someone speaks from the pulpit something that's, you know, politically explicit, that can cause harm to our communities, because, you know, ICE is not going to go to an Anglo church. You know, they're going to go to, you know, ethnic churches that are affiliated with that denomination. So we have to be careful. We have to protect our people.
I just made an appointment with the sheriff and just try to work every relationship to get in front of him and another sheriff, the two sheriffs, and just start to build that bridge and say, and then I invited some other clergy. So it wasn't just the rowdy Episcopalian, but got the rabbi, got a Lutheran, and then I got the Catholic pastor. And so we all went. And so when you walk in this sort of like united front, just say, hey, listen, this is not just a one denominational thing. Here we go. We got this big crossover of like a wide range of theology. We are super concerned. The people we serve, are just it's just chaos there, and we're seeing lives and families turned upside down and being destroyed. We have to do something, and we need your help in this. And you need to tell us what's going on here. How do we build a bridge here? How can we work together on this? Because you understand the job that I have. I understand the job that you have. And it was a really good, honest conversation. And he actually gave us advice on what to do and how to do it, because he gets it. And he told us what his objectives are. And they told us the realities, what it's like in Florida. And he told us about which agencies really are really doing it. And that if you really want to do the work of God, this is what you want to do. And if you want exactly what Mother Samara was saying, if you want to care for them, these are the smart things to do. Don't be driving in the front seat. Get an Uber so there's a white person in the front seat and you're in the back. You're not going to get pulled over. They're not going to racially profile you. All these things that you learn. And so now there's a bridge that's built there. Were there things we wanted to push back on? Absolutely. But that wasn't the point of the conversation at that point. It was to build a bridge. And so now we can go in a second time. And they're elected officials, the sheriff. They have to listen to you. They want to listen to you. You have parishes of 1,000 people. So your vote matters. And so, yeah, can we meet again? Hey, so one of your deputies got a little carried away here. They just took a person over, racially profiled them. They're over there. They're an American citizen. Like, what that would see? You trust me. Trust me, I'm telling you, this is not just BS. We're feeding you here. But it's all about relationships. I say making it work, the relationships you have in your parish or through other networks, to get in front of those officials, whether it's representatives, whether it's senators, and say as a concerned citizen, as a concerned clergy, as a concerned committee that you are at your church, and start to build that relationship and let your voice be heard. That helps tremendously. And also let you know what you can get away with too.
And that's a helpful reminder too, that it's not just either collusion or enmity with neighbors who may be in government or leaders or who may have totally different political ideologies than you. Don't presume enmity, at least on everything. That's a great reminder. Or come out of the gate swinging is maybe not always the right tactic to take. Maybe it's never the right tactic to take for a Christian. Father Jaime James, do you have something that you'd like to contribute here?
Now, our dynamic is quite different. I mean, only ICE could be the problem, or any other federal enforcement agency, or local officials cannot getting involved in this. We had ICE showing up at the front of the church because there's a hospital. So knowing that they're in the entrance of an emergency room was quite harrowing, but what else can we do? I'm not going to go and stand against them, but I guess I could get racially profiled now and be taken and deported or whatever.
Father Jaime, have you done any thinking or prep work about what would happen if enforcement activities occurred at your church, or if ICE showed up outside the narthex? I mean, are you sort of like,
right?
I'll pray about it when it happens, or have you thought about it?
No, we have private signs where they cannot go and all that. And I could not believe they battering at Baker Center, but you know, we'll be surprised. So that's the other part of it. I mean, I don't know what that would entail, but we do have a procedure like no one can get into the daycare unless we know who they are. And if there's someone that we don't know, we just talk to them through a camera and that's it. So we wouldn't open the doors. There's nothing else we can do. So
did you mention that you have signs that say private or private property or something like that?
Yeah, later in the church, inside the church, they can get inside the church, but I mean, we're a small community, so hopefully that means they won't target us, but who knows?
Okay. James, do you have something else to add here about churches responding to ICE hanging outside the door or some other kind of enforcement activity?
I would say two small things. The first is, from a lawyer's point of view, don't think about winning on that day. Think about winning the case. If ICE comes into your church, despite the fact that there's a sign that says private, keep out, and they arrest somebody in violation of the Constitution, that they may well not be able to deport someone who's legally removable from the United States because of the unlawful arrest. If you create a situation in which ICE has an excuse to do things by encouraging people to resist arrest, by yelling, run, whatever you happen to do. You can lose the long term by making a hostile or confrontational decision in the short term. The second thing that I would say is also about the long term, which is preventative steps that people can take if the worst happens. For example, parents can set up guardianship arrangements that trigger in the event of detention, right? So that somebody can pick up their kids from school and take care of them. People can set up powers of attorney so that their property can be accessed, their bank accounts can be accessed, and people can sign documents for the lawyer who's trying to get you out of jail. So one thing that can be done is to work with your parishioners to try to lay plans in advance in order to diminish the consequences of enforcement action.
Thank you. And on this subject, James, you have a word of advice about how parishes could help people identify safe places to go if they don't have all the T's crossed and all the I's dotted, they're still waiting for their green card or whatever, where they can go to get medical assistance or counseling, just social and medical services. What are some good tips there?
I don't think that there are any safe zones in that sense in this administration that they've sort of explicitly said, we're not going to observe those sorts of rules anymore. The question from my point of view is, what sort of provider is going to preserve confidentiality and offer a welcoming environment? And there, you know, lawyers, therapists, medical professionals all have ethical obligations. It's good to reassure people that, you know, your lawyer is not going to turn you over, your therapist is not going to turn you over, the hospital is not going to turn you over. But you shouldn't offer false reassurance either. You know, there's no place that ICE says that they can't go. And so you should offer measured reassurance in that way.
Thank you. What I'd like to do now is to ask each of you to share, if you'd like, anything that we've not covered today. Mother Samira, what would you share?
I think we didn't talk about the reality of the suffering, the significance of the ministry of presence. How do we help people who are in these situations, the displaced people, migrants, refugees, to see their suffering in a way that is meaningful, that is not useless, that God is with them and God is at work within that suffering. That's been a huge challenge. I have asylum seekers from my Farsi church. That's the only Farsi church, Episcopal church in the US. And what I've told them is, you know, at the camp there, at the detention camp, I've told them, look, you know, you are a missionary here. I know it's difficult, but focus on what you can do for others, how you can be a blessing to others, even, you know, as you deal with your own situation. So I think it'd be good for us to think about that and to find ways to help others kind of formulate their thoughts and their spirituality in a way that's redeeming. God is still at work. God is present.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. Father Jaime, is there something that you'd add as a final word?
Yeah, the need to care for those who are most in need. I feel more and more than the erosion of the civil liberties and the Constitution of the U.S. is a serious issue that should be cared by everybody. And it doesn't just affect the Latino community. While we are at the front end of the enforcement, those things have a wider repercussion than we seem to give it credit.
Thank you. Father Christian.
Find the things that you know that your community can do and just go do them. So for us, we knew at the time before we made relationships with immigration attorneys, we worked on food insecurity and transportation insecurity. And so we went for a grant that was, you can apply for so many different grants now, maybe through your diocese. That's what we did. Where we said, all right, we have a relationship with a Guatemalan community already. We're going to talk to the community leaders and we're going to say, what would it be if we came in with folks who speak Spanish and we're going to teach the elders how to use Walmart Plus? We're going to pay for the Walmart Plus accounts. We're going to give $100 credit on it. And then we're going to have to do these ways of building and teaching these workshops of how to download it, how to use it, food gets delivered to your door, because people are too afraid to go. Now they don't even go to Walmart at night now because the ICE is doing that. Transportation thing, Uber accounts for those. Now, that's not for everyone, but if they say yes and say, okay, do you want to do this, then we can set up the account. Again, it's a step-by-step process, lots of trust, lots of relationship building. If we didn't have those 8 years of relationship building, they probably said, no, thank you. But since we have those 8 years, then can that happen? So, and then the immigration thing is just more supporting the attorneys that you trust in getting a fund going and you can send money to them. I will say also too, if you have notaries in your congregation, if you have attorneys in your congregation, and have a night where we're going to have notaries and we're going to have attorneys and we're going to help get your kids passports, because God forbid you get deported, your kids need to have passports so they can go with you and come back. But you can facilitate that, but go first to a community leader like a Catholic church that already has the trust, already has the community. You know, it's almost like sort of like you're part of the Rebel Alliance. You got to find out who's in that you could really trust, that's really down for the cause, and you can offer that.
And maybe also watch the Star Wars series again and refresh yourselves on how that works. James, do you want to take us out with a final word of wisdom?
I'm not sure why you called upon the non-minister to do that. I want to thank all of you for helping these communities to not just deal with the difficult enforcement environment right now, but to do something more important, which is to care for them in their spiritual lives. It's important, I think, for lawyers to remember that. And so I want to say thank you on behalf of the bar for what you do.
It's lovely. Well, James, Christian, Jaime, Samira, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a beautiful conversation, and I trust that it's been helpful to you all who are listening. Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. Thanks again to the Episcopal Parish Network for hosting this conversation on their platform. And if you want to watch their video of this webinar, you can see the show notes. EPN has a whole archive of these online workshops completely free. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. You can learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. In 2 weeks, it's the most wonderful episode of the year, our annual cozy Christmas chat. This year, we have a natter over eggnog about Jane Austen for her 250th birthday with Austen scholars and superfans Haley Stewart and David Goodhue. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.